From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Appreciate you being on the program with us this month. And if ever you've got a question you would like to make it on the program, email that to news@wbaa.org. You can also tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Hey again to you. Did you get to see the eclipse at all the other day?
I'm happy to say I did. Wandered out on the mall and in the company of thousands of our students, and watched it with members of the astronomy clubs who were able to fill in gaps in my knowledge of events like that. I thought it was just terrific of the cosmos to arrange that as a way to launch the school year. We appreciate it.
Nicely lined up that way, yes. One more quick thing. Speaking of rare events, give me an over-under on the number of games you think the football team is going to win this year.
Well, you know I can only answer 12. who knows? But there is simply no doubt, and I spoke with the athletic director again yesterday, everyone, people more knowledgeable than I about the nuances and the football, all agree there's just a completely different outlook, mentality, and direction, sense of purpose. Obviously, some new players. So we don't expect instant miracles, but we fully expect to see something new and improved. And Coach Brohm promised that we'll be interesting to watch. And with his reputation as an offensive mastermind, who knows what that might mean.
Just real quick, I don't want to harp on this, but the first game of the season is at Lucas Oil Stadium against a marquee name in Louisville. It seems to be like a very high-risk, high-reward type game because you're playing it in a big place. You're going to have a lot of attention on it because it'll be the first game of the coach. But Louisville's been good. Like, if Louisville comes out and is Louisville and Purdue comes out and looks at all like Purdue has looked the last couple of years, is that the potential for a setback for the school, for the program?
It's the potential for a shocking upset win and a way to launch the Brohm era.
Let's think of it that way.
It is interesting because obviously these schedules are set years in advance.
Right.
And many years before anyone imagined that a Louisville graduate, mm-hmm. whose brother was another star at that school, as that program you just mentioned was getting launched, they were nowhere in football until Coach Schnellenberger and Jeff Brohm was one of the first leaders of a great Louisville team. And so there are a lot of, as you say in your business, storylines around this, including the fact they have the returning Heisman Trophy winner mm-hmm. and a highly ranked team. But we'll see what happens. I'll tell you, I'm excited about the bash we're going to have on Monument Circle the day before. We're expecting maybe thousands of Boilermakers and supporters and maybe just some folks who want to join us for some fun to have a rally in support of the team. So all by itself, that's a reason to look forward to next weekend.
Speaking of things that are going to go on Monument Circle, you're going to be at the Columbia Club giving a State of Purdue address that comes up a couple of days after we tape this program. Can you give us a couple of highlights? What are you going to be talking about?
Oh, I haven't thought too much about it yet, but it's not hard to know elements that will be included. By the way, this is sponsored by the Boilermaker Business Exchange, which was a self-started alumni group in Indianapolis area. It's only about 3 or 4 years old and already has hundreds of members, and they're the sponsors of that rally that will follow their meeting first. I'm sure I'll talk about a record class that just showed up in terms of numbers and in terms of academic readiness and in terms of diversity, all three. I'm sure that we'll talk about the growth of Purdue Research. We'll probably talk about State Street and the Innovation District and our hopes for what might blossom there and what is, I believe, started to, Rolls-Royce, now Infosys, and who knows who's next. So probably I'll touch on some of the highlights of what's going on and then let the audience direct direct the rest of the program through their questions.
Let's get to some questions that have come in from our listeners over the last month. And we had a number, interestingly, about Purdue's international student population, and I wanted to pose a few of those to you. Dave has written in, and he says, can foreign students, a couple of these are kind of piggyback on one another. He says, can foreign students get a student loan from a U.S. federal government or a private bank? He says, how can we make sure they pay it back if they go home after graduating? And what is the default rate on foreign student debt loans versus U.S. student loans?
They're not eligible, Dave, for student loans. So there are a lot of problems around student debt. And you're right to be concerned about that issue. International students is not one of those, not part of that problem.
Okay. So Dave had another question talking about the population on campus, and I'll just read verbatim what he says. He says, I have seen many foreign nationals living in graduate housing at Purdue, and they do not appear to be attending classes. Can a foreign student sponsor other foreign immigrants while attending a U.S. university on a student visa? And does Purdue do monthly checks on the grad student housing buildings to see how many people are living in each apartment or townhouse?
I'm not an immigration law expert, but I think the answer to the first question is no. And if they're living in our housing, they're going to school one way or another. Now, we have a high percentage of our graduate students who are international, and their schedules are different, obviously, than undergrads. They may be in labs or working on dissertations or projects more of their time than and then less of their time in classroom settings, but they're here to learn and study and earn a degree. So and on the second question, that we're required by the federal government to make certain reports about numbers and if anyone leaves and so forth, but it's not burdensome, and we are not an enforcement arm. We just simply report certain data to the federal government. They decide what to do or not.
All right. Another question has come in from Thea, who writes, one of the problems with so many foreign students is so many foreign teaching assistants that English-speaking students cannot understand. She says, why does this continue to be a problem?
Good question. It's a lesser problem than it's been, and we're working on it hard. Every student who wants to be a teaching assistant or is proposed to be one by a supervising faculty member must pass an English proficiency test, and we've been toughening that up over time. They can either pass the test or pass a course, as I recall, but they have to demonstrate their proficiency. You and I have discussed before, Stan, that at the undergraduate level, we've been raising steadily the required English, particularly spoken English, threshold for students to get in.
And these are the TOEFL scores, the test of English as a foreign language.
That's exactly right. And those scores, those thresholds are now higher than they've ever been. And this is important because in the new teaching mode that is more prevalent and in which we think Purdue is a leader, so-called active learning. We just opened the Active Learning Center, the Wilmoth Center, right in the middle of campus. It's not just the teachers who need to be fluent in English. Students themselves, in order to work on projects together or work on problem sets as a team, as they're more often called on to do, now need to be able to converse. And so we're working on this on all levels. We do have a smaller, significantly smaller percentage of the last two or three classes who are international. And within that, a much smaller percentage of those for whom English is not the first language. So still an issue, still a great question, but definitely one that is getting, I believe, more manageable every year.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. You can email questions at any time to be on this program. Our email address is news@wbaa.org. You can also tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about your letter to the campus community that you sent out at the beginning of this school year. And you spent a couple of paragraphs on the events in Charlottesville and how they kind of inform the way you're thinking about Purdue. What did you and your administration learn from or focus on as you were taking into account what happened there versus looking at the free speech issues that you and I have talked about on this program and that you've encountered in the last couple of years in West Lafayette?
Well, first, there was nothing remotely knew about what we said. It was wisely said a long time ago that sometimes the first duty of people is the restatement of the obvious. And our policy on this has been very plain spoken for a long time. I had written the students in a similar vein, the freshmen, a letter about our expectations that mentioned these same issues, among others, back in the summer. So it wasn't even the first communication they'd had. But given the timeliness of that particular event, which was only the most recent of some other regrettable events, it seemed important to talk about, and we've had some very positive feedback that we took that step.
So Purdue actually received a couple of mentions in national media following Charlottesville because of the white supremacist posters that showed up on campus last school year, and you were on this program and plenty of other places saying that those are fringe groups that you didn't want to give any additional press to if you could help it. But I wanted to ask you now, as you've had more time to think about it, as you've seen what Charlottesville had wrought, do you think that there's a larger racist or bigoted underbelly than people wanted to admit to?
No, I think it's infinitesimal. I think there are many people who perceive it, misperceive it as bigger than it is, or who find it useful to exaggerate. But, you know, there are public opinion polls and all sorts of data that tell us that there's essentially zero sympathy in America for that sort of activity.
I will say there was just a poll that came out that's and granted, any poll is only a limited number of people, but something like 1 in 10 respondents said that, you know, pro-neo-Nazi views weren't abhorrent to them.
Yeah. Well, let's just hope that, as has been the case, that we've had, I think, so little here. Interesting that we are mentioned in anybody's article, because there's so many campuses where there have been much more than cardboard posters, where there have been events that up to this point, happily, we have not had to deal with. And therefore, we have not had violence against protesters or by protesters. And that is not what our – as the letter said, that's not what students are here for. And we will – continue to protect everyone's right to speak, even speech we find abhorrent. You know, the ACLU took a very principled stand, I thought, not for the first time in their history, about the right of people to say things that we'd all condemn. But we think we can do that and still make our intolerance for any such speech or action, certainly action, plain.
Are you aware of any sort of classes on campus that take a look at or try to debunk some of these undercurrents, whether it's looking at the history of a neo-Nazi group or the KKK or something like that, these hate groups that are out there that are creating the protests like what we saw in Charlottesville?
You say debunk, you mean to...
To examine them, to take a look at, to keep what is, I think you're right, a relatively small population from growing and from spreading further hate.
Not to my knowledge, but we have literally thousands of courses, so I can't say that there aren't. I'm sure there are some that at least deal with these issues in some way. We have dozens of courses that deal with issues of race and so forth in different ways. And just as we protect the speech of faculty, staff, and students, we resolutely assert the right of our faculty to teach and offer any class they think's useful and important.
There are a number of cultural centers on campus. There's an African-American cultural mm-hmm. center, a Latino cultural center, several others. A couple of those have their own buildings. The African-American cultural center is a very, very nice facility. A couple of them are just housed in like off-campus or slightly on-campus houses that they've mm-hmm. bought. Would it be worth Purdue siphoning some resources from elsewhere to put into those cultural centers as a visible sign of reaffirming this multicultural welcoming environment that you talk about in your letter.
We do.
I mean, going even further than you do now.
Well, we'll see. I'll be over at the Black Cultural Center this afternoon, as it happens. Great place, and they have some great programming, and we're happy to support them in a variety of ways. Last time anybody tried to tally it up, and that's been several years, the university was spending $12 or $13 million minimum on all these activities and so-called diversity programs. I'm sure it's millions more than that now. So our investment in them is large, and it's sustained. You know, I tend to look at results on any such question. And we have broken records for the diversity of our student body in each of the last 3 years. And we're at unprecedented levels now. So I give these centers much of the credit for that, as well as our enrollment people, our deans. We're all working on that. We have some housing pinches and some difficulties that have come with a unexpectedly large freshman class again this year, but I'm willing to live with the temporary issues of that in exchange for a class that is, as I said, more diverse than it's ever been.
One more thing on this topic, and it's sort of by way of making up for a mistake that I think I made on a program a couple of months ago. You had said that you thought a lot of the college-based demonstrations over the last couple of years were the fault of kind of left-wing groups, you said. And I wondered, in the wake of Charlottesville, have you thought more about statements like that and wondered if it becomes a kind of false equivalence, that there's a difference between loudly protesting racism and bigotry and supporting the KKK?
Well, I'm not sure what you're asking. I mean, but we can – I would hope we can all agree that first, that we keep saying over and over, racism in any form is intolerable and ought to be confronted. I think we can also agree that throwing Molotov cocktails, taking axes or clubs or in one case we saw this summer, the attempted premeditated assassination of elected officials, is also intolerable. I don't think anybody's out there defending that, or what happened at Berkeley or what happened at Middlebury or some of these other places, where people were physically assaulted for views that people disagreed with. So, I don't see any conflict in condemning both sorts of behavior, and I fail to understand anyone who does.
You mentioned the housing shortage that you're facing for incoming students. You've talked a lot on this program about how you want to have as many people as possible live on or near campus because the data shows improves educational outcomes. There are something like 1,000 students who have had to be moved elsewhere from campus this year because of that unexpectedly large class you mentioned. And I wondered what your long-term plans are. Clearly, there's more housing going in along State Street. You've got 2,500, 3,000 beds, something like that, that are going in there. You've got plans to do more along State Street as it gets finished. Do you think you're going to have enough if demand continues to go up?
I think so. You know, first of all, a lot of progress has been made. The waiting list has been cleared. A lot of people have come out of the temporary housing where they were asked to double up or triple up, things like that. We didn't need to use the union, although we were prepared to. Still, we regret that even a single student was inconvenienced. Every student who turned in their application by the deadline was accommodated in housing. The waiting list was made up of people who came along later. And I guess the other thing I'd say is when you get to a class as big as we now have these days, 7,500 students or more, even a small miss is a lot of people. 1% is 75, and they only missed by a percent or two. But still, that's a problem. And so our folks have worked really hard to to ameliorate it as fast as possible. You make a really good point, which I've asked people to do our people to do a big analysis of. By my count, the intended projects, most of which are already approved, private projects on the boundaries of campus, amount to something like 3,000 beds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we weren't expecting that 2 or 3 years ago. And so we want to see if we can discern what the net change will be. We know that a lot of the students who will opt for those places might otherwise take private places in West Lafayette.
But they're likely to be more expensive on a per-month basis than living on campus.
They probably will be, yeah. And how they'll compare to the private housing that's been rented forever and a day, you know, on the in the nearby neighborhoods, I don't know. My understanding is that folks in West Lafayette in general believe it's a good thing if fewer students are living in those neighborhoods. And so I know some of them will, let's say, cannibalize that market. But the numbers are so big that we have to believe – I have to believe that it will provide new capacity, maybe a considerable amount of it, that might make recurrences of this year's inconvenience less likely.
So you think it'll be okay if Purdue students find their way into those places because they are – well, not on campus, certainly near to campus.
They're pretty close, and especially with the knitting together of campus through on the State Street project, I think that we feel that from a proximity standpoint, those students will have about the same advantage that we've been associating, that the data associates with on campus university housing. Now, whether we can bring support services close enough to those students, so-called student success programs, the kind we have in our residence hall, that's a different question. But we know there's a plus that comes simply from proximity. And these new units more or less, I think, meet that test.
On to another thing. We haven't had a chance to talk to you yet on this program about the review that Purdue is doing of a summer camp that happened this past summer where there were allegations of violence and sexual assault. This is the Camp Dash. I wanted to check in with you on what that investigation has found so far. It's still in the relatively early stages, but I wanted to ask you where that was going.
Well, it's proceeding, and I've told the compliance office that I don't see any reason this needs to take too long. We want to know. People deserve to know. Those who will decide whether or not this research should be renewed next year need to know. So I don't have anything to report yet, but we don't want or expect this to be a protracted process.
Normally, I think summer camps are for students who share a particular affinity, and this one was a little different in that it was conducting research based on how students who were prone to high blood pressure, how their sodium intake affected them. Is Purdue at all rethinking that idea of bringing kids in and having them be part of an experimental model?
I think you always want to reexamine this. I mean, we have a very established process that was followed here before any human at any age takes part in research.
And I guess we should say that it is highly common that universities, especially large research universities, have very strict human research policies.
Right. And they're observed, I think, scrupulously here. There were 100 more or less camps of different kinds on our campus this summer. Some research based, others for more learning purposes, and all the rest went off fine. This one, as you know, in its first session, there were some issues about some scraps and fights. Those students were not invited back for the second session, and the group that met on it believed they had dealt effectively with the problem. Then one single girl committed all these acts in the second session, and she had not done it in the first session, so they didn't expect or anticipate the actions that she committed.
So one of the things you've been talking about is the supervision of the camps and taking a look at assessing whether students are ready to continue going. What do you want to know in terms of that supervisory role that the university plays?
I'm just going to say results are what count. And so they did some more training. They added some staff for the second session, and it didn't suffice to catch this one girl or to stop her from the second and third assault on somebody. So we'll wait for the report. The purposes here were very admirable, not just research on children's health, which is very important, but the whole idea was to give these young people, many of whom came from lower income areas, give them a chance to see a college campus, get a little summer learning, make a little money. And again, every other camp we had of every character worked out just fine. This particular one, studying slightly different health issues, had operated in the past effectively. So I don't want to indict a whole system over this, but results do matter, and we'll see what can be learned so that if we have these sorts of camps again, that that surveillance and scrutiny and supervision is even tighter.
Let me ask you about that on the front end. How are students screened before they are to come to a sleepaway camp, which might be a very different experience than what a lot of them mm-hmm. have experienced before going to just a summer day camp or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, good question that I hope the inquiry will reveal. It's obviously in the hands of the researchers who have to get a population for their study that they think is scientifically sound and statistically sound. But in this case, what else was done, I don't know.
Is the panel at all looking at the specific experiment, looking at whether the for instance, the food that was given to the students, which was being monitored for sodium intake, had anything to do with whether it could have affected the outcomes of the actual student behavior?
I want them to look at anything that might have a bearing. I don't – that to me seems rather far-fetched, you know, that – to connect anything that, for instance, the young girl ate or didn't with
this
little rampage she went on. But, yeah. But you know.
We know that imbalances in chemistry can do strange things.
That's an interesting question, and I'll mention that if they hadn't, at least ask it.
One more quick thing. You've got some finalists to replace Vicky Carwine as chancellor at IPFW. A couple of them come from the Purdue system. One is Carl Drummond, who's been IPFW's vice chancellor of academic affairs. Another, Dan Herleman, who serves as the chief corporate and global partnerships officer here on the West Lafayette campus. Just in 30 seconds, do those two have any sort of a leg up, being that they already know the system a little bit?
They might. I'm glad that the final four, all of whom have been interviewed on the campus, and so I'm waiting now for all the feedback from faculty and from others who had a chance to visit and interrogate them. But I'm glad we have a mix. We have two from inside. We have two highly qualified people from elsewhere. And one of the things we'll be looking for is advice not only about individual characteristics, but would it be better to have somebody who already knows the system or somebody coming in totally fresh? I'm agnostic on it, and we'll wait for advice.
All right. Thanks for your time. This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's Monthly Conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels.
Major support for the Monthly Conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Gaylor Electric. Gaylor provides electrical services from pre-construction design through project completion and a 24/7 service department. Information at Gaylor.com.